It's my pleasure this morning to introduce Gershon Gorenberg, who's the author of a new book, The Unmaking of Israel. His previous books include The Accidental Empire, Israel and the Birth of the Settlements, as well as The End of Days, Fundamentalism and the Struggle for the Temple Mount. In 2010, Mr. Gorenberg was a visiting professor at Columbia's Graduate School of Journalism. He's appeared often as a commentator on Middle East affairs on various programs, such as 60 Minutes, Nightline, CNN's BBC, senior correspondent for the American Prospect. He's also written for the Atlantic Monthly, New York Times Magazine, New York Review of Books, Foreign Policy, and in Hebrew for Haaretz. He blogs at southjerusalem.com. Please welcome Gershon Gorenberg.
This mic is set up for Elliot's height, not mine, so just a moment. Thank you. First of all, I'd like to thank you for being here. I'd like to thank Torah in Motion for making it possible for me to be here and for their wonderful programs and for the openness of debate within a context of respect that they've created here and that so impressed me yesterday evening during the panel. I'm very grateful for being able to be part of that discussion. Before I start, I need to tell a well-known story, which is not historical but should be, in the sense that it tells the truth. As you all know, there was once a Jew who was the survivor of a shipwreck, was stranded on a South Pacific island for 20 years, and when another ship finally found him there, the captain found that the Jew had not one but three huts on the beach. And the captain said, "What are these?" And the Jew pointed to one and said, "This is my house." And he pointed to the second one and he said, "This is my shul." And then the captain said, "So what's the third one?" And he said, "That's the shul that I don't daven in." So I mention this because I want to clear up any misunderstandings at the outset. At one point in this talk, I'm going to refer to the Second Israeli Republic, and I know that somebody's going to say, "I knew there had to be another one. We can switch membership. Where is it? New Zealand, Uganda, the Upper West Side?" So I want to explain from the outset that Israel is a complete anomaly in Jewish history in many ways, including the fact that there's only one. You can't join the other one. And when I refer to the Second Israeli Republic, it's in a matter of time, not place, in the sense that people talk about the Fifth French Republic, a reorganization of the polity, not another republic elsewhere. I also want to add a tiny bit to the resume with which Elliot introduced me. That was the professional resume, so I want to add a little bit of the personal side. In one sense, I should be in the other session right now on the gap year as an example of one possible outcome of going to study in Israel for a year. In my case, after college rather than before, I went to study Torah in Israel for a year. That was 34 years ago. It's been a very long year, and I'm very happy that I made the decision at the end of that year to stay. Some of the parents over there might be interested that that's one possible consequence of allowing your kid to go off to study in Israel for a year. I stay because it is a place where the Jewish issues are the public issues, where the debate about Jewish values is a debate about the values that will be expressed by the polity, by the state, and because I found one after another, individual involvement of Israelis in public affairs, which was beyond anything that was imaginable in North America. Today, I've been married for 25 years. I have three children. Two of them are now serving in the Israel Defense Forces. One of them, my little girl, 20 years old, is a lieutenant and is in command of 25 people. And I'm very, very proud of that. So I'm talking about when I discuss the issues I'm raising today, I'm raising them from the inside as an Israeli, as somebody who's very committed to my country. I want to talk about the history of Israel as a democratic and Jewish state, what the threats are to that, and what can be done to meet those threats. Now, the phrase democratic and Jewish state or Jewish and democratic state, depending on which way you put it, that's probably an ideological statement in itself, is the most debated phrase in Israeli politics. Everybody uses it. Nobody's quite sure what they mean by it. In particular, are the terms democratic and Jewish in conflict, in tension, or do they complement each other? And so I will argue both sides of that case because I believe in both sides of that case. On one side, there's the view as best expressed by Israeli political philosopher and law professor Chaim Gantz that nationalism, the idea of ethnic self-determination, that my group should have a place where the public space and the polity are expressions of my culture, is ultimately a right of the individual. Each individual is a very basic part of his or her identity, has a culture, has a belongingness, wants to express that in the public space, and that self-determination through political independence or some other form of political arrangement is an expression of that individual right. However, I would add to what Gantz says that individual rights inherently conflict with each other, and much of what courts do is adjudicating the conflict between rights. There's a right to the free press, but as in the famous example, it doesn't give you the right to cry fire in a crowded theater. I find every time I go through an airport, at least in the United States, that my right to personal dignity is deeply offended by the whole security process, but I also have a right to personal security for which that process in some form is necessary. So the right of the Jewish majority to self-determination can come into the conflict with the rights of the minority in various ways, and those rights have to be adjudicated in order to create a state that's both democratic and Jewish. The second approach, and much as I acknowledge that the first approach is true on a technical level, I think in a deep Jewish way, I think that the second approach gets more to the heart of something true and part of my soul, is that Israel must be democratic precisely because it is a Jewish state. That democracy in the deep sense is not just majority rule, but respect for the minority, for diversity, and that those are core, basic, rooted Jewish values. The Torah tells us in Vayikra, in Leviticus, that when a stranger lives with you in your land, do not oppress him. The stranger living with you will be like one of you, for you are strangers in the land of Egypt. Now, this pasuk has been applied, and many that repeat the same sentiment has been applied for the last 2,000 years, mainly in the context of the Geret Tzedek, of the convert to Judaism. But the reason for that, I mean, that's good and important in of itself, but the reason that that's been the primary meaning is that Jews' only polity, in a sense, was their religious community. So the only stranger who could be part of their community, at least for the first moment be a stranger, was somebody who came from the outside and became a Jew religiously. But the original meaning of the pasuk refers to in your land. When you are a sovereign society in your land, you are required to treat those who are not members of your Jewish tribe as equals. That can be expressed in various ways in various times, just as the mitzvah to heal did not always require using the same medicine. But in our time, the best way to express the most effective way to express that respect for the other is through a democratic system. Moreover, throughout modern history, since Jews began to enter modern Western societies, they have rightly demanded equality in those societies as a minority. If we do not see that demand as instrumental and indeed hypocritical, I want rights for the minority because I'm a member of the minority, but I don't really believe in that in a principle. If we believe in the right of the minority to equality as a principle, as a universal principle, if we were being acting with integrity when we have demanded that in the countries of Europe or in the countries of North America or elsewhere, then we surely must be consistent and apply that principle when we are in the majority. And therefore, both Jewish tradition and recent historical Jewish experience demand that a Jewish state be a democratic state. And in fact, that is what Israel's Megillat Atzmaut Declaration of Independence expresses very clearly. With that philosophical beginning, I can go to the history. Once, when I was the opinion editor of the Jerusalem Report, a job which I held for many years, I had a columnist who submitted a column which I included something which I could politely call a factual error. And I said, I can't print that. It's not true. And he said, it's my opinion. So I said, okay, I have to explain to you how an opinion article works. In an opinion article, you can interpret the facts as you want, but the facts have to be facts. And as an example, I said you can say that it's wonderful that the state of Israel was established on May 14, 1948, or you can say that it's terrible that the state of Israel was established on May 14, 1948, but you can't say that the state of Israel was established in 1953. Okay? That's how an opinion article works. Well, afterwards, perhaps in a certain Talmudic way, I realized that I had given a terrible example. Because I myself can make very good arguments for the fact that the state of Israel was actually established on different dates. In fact, when I gave a version of this talk at a university a week ago, I threatened to give a test the following week in which each student would have to argue for a date besides May 14, 1948 for the establishment of the state of Israel. So let me use that framework to talk a little bit about the founding of the state. It's true that Israel was formally declared as a state on the afternoon of May 14, 1948, that this was a realization of the basic goal of Zionism. Jews, defined as a nation, as an ethnic group, achieved political independence in part of their homeland, the place where they would be the majority, not, I would stress, as a mythic event, not as part of Ketzer Yamim, the end of days, but as a real-world, practical, political event. It's also true that this presented the founders of the state with what surely must have been a difficult personal and political transformation, because they were revolutionaries, and if there's one thing that's more difficult for revolutionaries than defeat, it is victory. Because when you win, you have to go from being a revolutionary to a member of an institution. You have to be in charge. You have to be a bureaucrat or a politician rather than a revolutionary. You have to respect the laws. Previously, you could relate to the laws as those of the outside oppressor to whom you gave no legitimacy. Now, the laws are the ones that you are creating yourself. And if you want a democracy, surely you must accept the rule of law, the equality of the law for all citizens, and even that the law even restricts, or most importantly, restricts the actions of the government itself. And if you are, if your particular form of revolution was a national liberation movement, as Zionism was, you find yourself in a completely different situation, because up to now you were only responsible for your national group, but now you're responsible for all the citizens of the country that you now rule. Israel, I would stress, is remarkable among the baby boom countries, the countries which achieved independence after World War II, because it has remained a parliamentary democracy continuously since its founding. This is nothing to be taken for granted if we look at the experience elsewhere in the world. But I could argue that the state was actually established on other dates. For instance, on... This is supposed to move now. All right. I'll get to this document in a moment, but we could argue that the state was actually created in late April of 1948, before the formal founding, because that's when the administrative plan for the state, something called the Report of the Situation Committee, was completed. The Situation Committee was set up in fall of 1947. The situation was that the Jewish leadership in Palestine, in Mandatory Palestine, realized that within a few months they might be leaders of a state, and they had to design an administration, not in the constitutional sense, but in the bureaucratic sense. How many veterinary inspectors would there be? How many ministries would there be? Who would be responsible for what? Would the budget be down to the last lira? And they worked, the leaders of the Zionist movement worked on this until April of 1948. It's an amazing document precisely because it's so boring and bureaucratic and technical, and therefore important for the creation of a state. Among its built-in assumptions, for instance, is that the state is responsible for the health care of all citizens, a principle which seems obvious enough where I'm standing now, but not so obvious south of the border, but was certainly, even though, just to give you a sense of what physical, real health care was in 1948, in the newborn state of Israel. I have a cousin who was born in 1948 in the 32nd week of his mother's pregnancy. in the port in Haifa on a ship, and there was no incubator in the city of Haifa, and he was stuck between two hot water bottles for 6 weeks until he his body was big enough to keep itself warm. So the level of medicine was very low, but the report required the state to provide medical care for all. And among those listed as people for whom the state was concerned about providing medical care was the entire Arab population of what was assigned to the Hebrew state by the partition plan. Likewise, for education, the report discusses Arab education in 242 Arab villages and a number of Arab towns that would be inside the Hebrew state. This is important because I actually was sent to see this document by another historian. He said, if you look at this document, which was recently uncovered by a third historian, and there's no mention of the Arabs, you'll know that there was a plan, or you'll have strong evidence that there was a plan to expel the Arabs in 1948. And the fun part was that the document proved the opposite. It proved that the state was planning on the Arabs remaining in place. Now, we know that that's not what happened. Professor Morris has written about that at great length and in great detail and very well. The reality was that there was a war between Arabs and Jews within the area of what was to become the Jewish state, and afterwards a war between Israel and its Arab neighbors, that what began as a panicked flight of the Arab population was in some places aided and abetted by expulsion by, at least on the local level, by units of the Israeli army, and that the refugees were not allowed to return. Those who were left, a fraction of the Arab population, found themselves at the beginning of the state in a contradictory situation of being both outsiders suspected of being a fifth column and citizens of the state with the right to vote. And so the ideal of full equality, while it's one that has slowly been pursued over the last 63 years, is one that we're still, in the best reading of events, working to achieve. The second possible date that I could give you, other than the official one, for the establishment of the state is late June 1948, and that the true birth pains were what is known as the Altalena Affair. In the Altalena Affair, the Irgun, or Etzel Underground, a far-right underground that had broken off from the Haganah, from the mainstream Jewish militia in pre-state days, led by Menachem Begin, attempted to bring a ship full of arms to the State of Israel. Only a few weeks before, Begin had signed an agreement, as noted here in a memo. The way that these documents are set up, by the way, when I'm showing them on the screen, is in one spot you'll see the original document written from east to west, which I found in various parts of Israeli official archives. In this case, in the Israeli state archives, this is a note from David Ben-Gurion to Yisrael Galili, his main military aide, from June 20th of 1948. And in the top, for those of you who don't read from east to west, I've put a west to east translation. So Begin had signed an agreement on June 1st, 1948, to integrate the Irgun into the newly formed Israel Defense Forces, with its units becoming battalions in the IDF, and to cease purchasing arms separately. Nonetheless, Begin informed the leadership of the state later in June that an arms ship packed with very large supplies of arms was arriving from Marseille, and that the Irgun intended to unload this ship, and that it wanted the arms to go to its units within the Israeli army. Essentially, it was functioning as if those units... Thank you so much. Too many airplane flights. The units of the Irgun in the army were still primarily responsible to the political organization, to the Irgun, and not to the national government. The original plan, in fact, had been to bring those arms on the day that the British left Palestine, to conquer all of Palestine, and to establish a government under the Irgun. That is to say, to take power in the Jewish state by force of arms and to impose its policy. In any case, the cabinet and Prime Minister Ben-Gurion told the Irgun that they would not be allowed to maintain their own control of these arms. and that they would have to turn them over to the army because you couldn't keep a politically linked faction within the army. The Irgun refused to obey this order. It began unloading the arms on the beach at Kfar Vitkin near Netanya. There was a battle between the IDF and the Irgun on the beach there. Then the ship was moved to the coast of Tel Aviv. If you ever stay in one of the high-rent hotels in Tel Aviv, the Sheraton or the Hilton, the battle between the Irgun and the Palmach, the elite unit of the IDF, took place on that stretch of the beach. You can look out your hotel window and see where it happened, even if it's not marked there. And finally, when the Irgun refused to turn over its arms, Ben-Gurion ordered the artillery corps to fire at the ship. The ship was hit, the crew abandoned ship, and the ship was later sunk. Ben-Gurion said in the cabinet, explaining what had happened, "The moment that the army and the state surrender to another armed force, we have nothing left." This episode established that Israel would fit the definition of a state as laid out by the towering political sociologist Max Weber, that the state is the entity which has the monopoly on the legitimate use of force in a particular territory. It also established at least a basis, a sufficient though not necessary condition for Israel to be a democracy, because in a democracy, politics are not conducted via armed groups. This is not at all obvious. In Greece, a civil war, a brutal civil war, was still in progress when Israel was established between the different movements which had liberated Greece from the Nazis. In Angola, a civil war between the different liberation movements lasted for a decade and a half. And I could give more examples. So the fact that the state managed to establish at the very beginning that there would be one army, that it would be controlled by the government, that that would be a civilian government, and that there would not be political factions controlling parts of the army, this was no small achievement. In a sense, it was establishment of the state. Another date is that in the winter and spring of 1949, Israel signed armistice agreements with its Arab neighbors. On an international level, these were de facto armistice lines for the internal purposes of the state of Israel. However, these became the de jure borders. Those were the lines up to which Israeli law applied. Those were the lines in which the state had the legitimate use of the monopoly on the legitimate use of force. And those were the lines in which, in a democracy, everybody within those lines became citizens of the state, so that the government was ruled by the consent and control of the governed. The actual beginning of the actual beginning of the democracy was on January 25th, 1949, when the first elections were held for the Knesset. It's important to note in the context of Israel today that the first motion of no confidence in the new government was submitted by the same Menachem Begin, now a member of the Knesset. He was upset that Ben-Gurion had turned down General Yigal Alon's proposal to conquer the West Bank at the end of the War of Independence, and Ben-Gurion said, "Let's say we can conquer all the western land of Israel militarily, which I am sure we could. Then what? We will make one state, but that state will want to be democratic. There will be general elections, and we will be in the minority. When the question arose of having the entire land without a Jewish state, or a Jewish state without the entire land, we chose a Jewish state without the entire land." Finally, I could give a final date for the establishment of Israeli democracy in the deep sense of not just majority rule, but respect for the minority. That is, in October of 1953, alas, the date that I told my columnist that he could not use as an example, the Supreme Court delivered its ruling in what is known as the Kol Ha'am case. Kol Ha'am was a newspaper owned by the Communist Party. It means literally the voice of the people, perhaps more idiomatically, the voice of the masses. There was a deep political split in Israel in its early years of whether to be pro-East Bloc or pro-West Bloc. The Communist Party obviously stood with those who were pro-East Bloc. It ran an editorial bitterly attacking Ben-Gurion's stand on the Korean War. And the government, using a British colonial law, ordered the paper closed for 15 days as a punishment. The newspaper turned to the Supreme Court. Justice Shimon Agronaut, an American-born and raised judge, showed judicial audacity, activism, and courage in the best senses of the word, and ruled that you cannot do that, that the state had defined itself as a democracy. He then went back to the philosophical sources of modern democracy to show that democracy requires a free press and free debate. He acknowledged that Israel had no tradition of precedent, of legal precedent, on the issue of the free press because it was such a new state, and thereby permitted himself to import as a package American legal precedent on the free press, and ruled that a government could not close a newspaper because it didn't like what it had said politically. This is probably the greatest contribution ever made by a North American immigrant to the state of Israel. And since then, we have, as I said, continued to have a parliamentary democracy, extremely high political participation, judicial restraint of the executive and legislative branches, and most recently, a very growing and intense participation of civil society groups in the politics of the country. At the same time, we face some very serious threats created by short-sighted policies, decisions with unexpected results, and all the more so, refusals to make decisions at critical junctures. One of those threats is posed by the entanglement of state and religion. And that, I would say, is a threat not only to the state, but to the shape of Judaism in the state. To give you one example of one of the unintended consequences, there's a building in the Jerusalem neighborhood of Romema, are a set of buildings upstairs above the ground. What you see is a housing development for the ultra-Orthodox, for the Haredi community, a series of very nice apartment blocks, the inhabitants of which are apparently either Haredim who immigrated from abroad and therefore learned a profession and actually have jobs, or those who are working in the rabbinic establishment and therefore have incomes. Underneath is a three-story parking garage. And as I found when I wandered around one afternoon in this garage, the residents upstairs, as is very common in Israeli apartment complexes, have little storerooms in the garage area where they can do what you would do in the garage of a single-family home. You can store your sukkah there when it's not Sukkot. You can put your boxes there. You can put your baby carriage in there when you're not using it and so forth, except that on many of these storerooms there were doorbells and names on the door and water meters because the storerooms, which I measured as 8 paces by 8 paces, had been rented out to impoverished young Haredi families who could not afford anywhere else to live, reflecting the drastic rise, the Dickensian rise in poverty within a community which has learned a lifestyle in which the great majority of adult men do not work but spend their lives studying Torah. Contrary to what too many tour guides tell you when you're visiting Mea Shearim, this is not how our great-grandparents lived in Europe. Okay? There was never a Jewish society in which all the men studied, or even which more than a tiny minority of the men spent their lives studying. The creation of that society is a result of an unexpected consequence of an early decision of the state, in itself a understandable and partially positive decision. The state at its outset, when it not only believed it was obligated to provide health care, but education, very early in the state, in 1949, a law was passed providing free education at that point through 8th grade, later extended through high school. The existing school systems in the Jewish community, the organized Jewish community which had existed before statehood, were 3 politically linked school systems. One was connected to the labor Zionist movement, one was connected to the religious Zionist movement, and one was what was called a general Zionist system, which meant the bourgeois capitalist Zionists. The state began knowing that politically it could not yet break up those systems, so it funded them. But there were schools that were outside the organized Zionist community, like the tiny number of ultra-Orthodox schools. And so the state allowed the ultra-Orthodox to organize their own school system and funded it as well. The result of this was that a 19-year-old ultra-Orthodox woman finishing a teacher seminary could get a job, and as leaders of the decimated ultra-Orthodox community realized, she could support a husband who could then stay in yeshiva, a radical, unheard of development in Jewish life, that a whole class of women would work and support their husbands to study, originally for 10, 15 years until they left and got some sort of religious job. As time went on, the number of religious jobs ran out, and more of those men have come to be students their entire lives. When the state was established, the marriage age, birth rate and employment level of the Haredi community was the same as the general Jewish community. Today, the marriage age in the Haredi community is a median of 20 for men and 19 for women. The average birth rate is somewhere around 7 to 8 per woman. Remember that's an average that takes into account those who, for various sad reasons, are unable to have as many children. It's common to run into families of 10 or 12 children. And the average is for men, the common situation is for men not to work. And this is, besides everything else, allowed the community to become more and more extreme in its interpretation of halakha because it doesn't need to interact with the outside world. It means that the state is supporting schools where, to quote Orthodox Israeli sociologist Menachem Friedman, the pioneering scholar of the sociology of Israeli ultra-Orthodoxy, it's a community in which the schools prepare you for the economy of the next world, not for the economy of this world, and in which you get no training in the basic skills provided by the humanities and for participating in a democratic debate. Moreover, because of political necessity at the beginning of the state continued the Ottoman and British model of a chief rabbinate that's responsible for marriage and divorce and conversion. But politically, as the ultra-Orthodox have grown and gained more power, they have pretty much taken over that system and apply their ever more stringent rules to the way that Jewish law is interpreted in those courts. Once upon a time, it was the confident feeling of the modern Orthodox abroad that the Israeli rabbinate was their partner and they tended not to have a problem with this arrangement. That partnership is part of history because the rabbinate today regards most modern Orthodox rabbis abroad as little better than, in their eyes, using their system of evaluation, little better than Reform or Conservative rabbis. It does not accept the conversions or gittin of most of those people and has recently gradually introduced a radical innovation in halakha which says that conversion is conditional, that conversion is only valid if the convert was sincere, and the sincerity of the convert can be determined by his or her behavior even decades later, so that if somebody is less than completely observant by today's standard, it means that he or she was not really converting back in the past. This undermines the entire basis of conversion in halakha. It's typical of movements which claim to be old-time religion, be they Jewish, Islamic, Christian, Hindu, or others, which is that they are as much part of modernity and as innovative as every other modern movement. Or to put it differently, conservative Judaism or modern Orthodox Judaism are aware of the fact that they are creations of modernity. Ultra-Orthodoxy claims not to be, but it is as much a modern creation as the others are. But more importantly, for a democratic basis, that minority has control of critical aspects of life like marriage and divorce for the rest of the Israeli community. A second set of unintended consequences all the greater effect was by Israel's necessary victory in the 1967 war. The war was unplanned. Weeks beforehand, Israeli military intelligence was predicting that there would be no war with the Arab states for the next 8 to 10 years. The Arabs were clearly not prepared militarily to challenge Israel in a war. It's a classic case of the intelligence getting the facts right and, you know, back to my opinion article, and the interpretation wrong. Israel did not plan on conquering the Sinai Peninsula, the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and the Golan Heights in April or May of 1967, but that's where the war led. Contrary to von Clausewitz's principle that war is an extension of policy by other means, the state. There you have the picture of the pre-war and post-war borders. The state had to decide what to do with this territory, the Sinai, the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, and the Golan Heights. The biggest problem was with the West Bank and Gaza. In the cabinet discussion of the future of the West Bank in June 19, 1967, Justice Minister Yaakov Shimshon Shapira, responding to proposals of other cabinet ministers, said that holding the West Bank with its Arab population and not giving them the vote was impossible in a, quote, in a time of decolonialization, unquote. And on the other hand, keeping the land and giving the Arabs the vote meant, quote, we're done with the Zionist enterprise, unquote. Essentially, he was rephrasing what Ben-Gurion had said in the Knesset 18 years before that, that you couldn't have a Jewish state in the whole land and have it be a democracy. This was not the criticism of some campus radical in Paris or in Berkeley. This was the justice minister of the State of Israel, and it was echoed in other secret documents that I found from the summer of 1967. Nonetheless, for a series of complex reasons, the government was unable to reach a decision. In an absence of a policy, political culture, and the initiatives of individuals who did know what they want took the place of policy. One example of this is a document which I found from 1967, October 1967, in the office files of Yigal Alon, now the Minister of Labor in Prime Minister Levi Eshkol's government. The Ministry of Labor included the Survey Department, which at that time had a virtual monopoly on maps in the State of Israel. Alon wrote to the head of the Survey Department, from today on, maps of Israel are to be printed as follows. The title will be Israel and the subtitle map of the ceasefire lines. The mandatory borders and the armistice lines will not be printed on the new map for normal use. In other words, Alon erased what was the legal boundary of the State of Israel for Israeli purposes from Israeli maps. From here on in, bored fifth grade kids listening to the buzz in the background of their teacher's voice and staring at the map of their country on the bulletin board would not see the actual legal borders of the State of Israel. And in 2007, 40 years after this document was written, two Hebrew University geographers did a study among students at Hebrew University and Bar-Ilan University. They found that at Hebrew University, one-third of the students, and at Bar-Ilan University, one-quarter of the students were able to roughly draw the green line, the pre-67 boundary, on a map. That is to say, people lost the picture of the shape of their own country. I would guess that in this room, if I asked you to take out a piece of paper, depending on your artistic skills, the quality might vary, but you could all draw a picture of Canada. But the average, the majority of students at Hebrew University, the most selective university in Israel, were unable to draw a map of the borders of the State of Israel. The borders became something equivalent to sex in Victorian society, critically important for all aspects of life, not to be talked about publicly and certainly not in front of the children. but that removes a basic element of the modern state, a border. On the ground, the borders were in fact blurred by the beginning of settlement in the West Bank, again, not by a single strategic decision. The first settlement in the West Bank, as I mentioned last night, the first settlement in the occupied territories was in the Golan in July of 1967, supported by top government officials and officers, despite the fact that it violated Israeli law and policy at the time. Essentially, what was going on is that those officials who had made the transition from revolutionary to bureaucrats were now finding the opportunity to regain their youth, to set the borders by building settlements, to defy the law, to defy policy, except that the law and policy that they were now defying was that of the very Jewish state, which was their own proudest achievement. Obviously, this wasn't conscious, but this was what was going on. The state was being undermined. Before the establishment of the first settlement in the West Bank, Kfar Etzion, Prime Minister Eshkol asked the legal advisor of the foreign ministry to whether or not it was legal for Israel to settle its civilians in the newly conquered territory. Theodore Meiron, the legal advisor, the top official within the Israeli government, the person tasked within the Israeli government to interpret international law for the government, responded, my conclusion is that civilian settlement in the administered territories contravenes explicit provisions of the Fourth Geneva Convention, that is to say, violates international law. Now, lest you think, or lest you be convinced by somebody that Meiron is some sort of outlier or somebody without connection to Jewish history, let me for a moment, despite the fact that it's going to make you all feel terribly inadequate, tell you Theodore Meiron's biography. Theodore Meiron was born in Poland in 1930. He spent his youth in Nazi labor camps. He arrived in Palestine in 1947 at the age of 17, not having gone to school. In the following 10 years, he completed high school. his Israeli Army service, his law degree at Hebrew University, his doctorate in law at Harvard, and his postdoc in international law at Cambridge, and returned to Israel to join the Foreign Service. He served by 67 at the age of 37. He had become legal advisor of the foreign ministry. 10 years later, feeling that he had gone as far as he could with diplomacy, he decided to return to academia. He accepted a position as a professor of international law at New York University, where he became one of the recognized, if not the recognized, expert on the face of the globe on the laws of war as they pertain to civilians in the time of war. He wrote the theoretical underpinning for the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. He was appointed to that court by the U.S. government when it was formed and became president of that court for several years, and at the age of 81 still serves on the appeals panel of that court. So I can go through the whole art. In fact, if you want a longer discussion of the international law issue, I do, and why Mehron's opinion is the simple meaning of international law and settlement, I have that in my book. What I can say now is this is the gold standard. In any case, Mehron's opinion also included the idea that it was permissible for the government to establish temporary military bases in occupied territory. On the day that Kfar Etzion was established, the 27th of September, 1967, this order was issued by the top army officer in charge of administering the territories. It says, as a cover for the purposes of the diplomatic battle, the outpost of the religious youth in the Etzion bloc will appear as a military Nahal outpost. There is no intent of taking any practical steps by the IDF to implement this cover. In other words, the newspaper, the reports, and the diplomatic cables of the time show that the government presented Kfar Etzion as being part of the army. The army and the settlers themselves were well aware that there was no connection between the two. It was a cover. I found this document in the Israeli Defense Forces archives after a 5-year legal battle for access to the archives. So what was going on here is that now the state itself was acting like the young revolutionary, defying or dodging the law for the sake of setting borders through settlement. It also, by doing so, the settlement project from this moment onward was not only supported but initiated in most cases by the government, first of labor, and then in a much wider level by the Likud after 1977. But particularly for settling deep in the territory, the most eager recruits were from that wing of religious Zionism, really a new wing of religious Zionism created by the ecstasy after the 67 war that turned settlement, the land, and not pulling back into the core values of Judaism. Before 67, religious Zionism was known as a moderate to dovish political force in Israel. by supporting the settlements, and in particular ways by particularly supporting educational institutions in the settlement, the government inadvertently, without any plan to do so, also altered the shape of Orthodox Judaism in Israel. And one final aspect of this is that beginning in the late 1980s, as the army found that fewer people from the original secular elite who used to fill the officer corps were interested in this, some of this for sociological reasons. In the early years of the state, the only way you could really get ahead was through the army. The state was created by people who were young. As I said, for instance, Yigal Alon, who was the general of the Southern Front in the War of Independence, was 31 at the time, full general at the age of 31. Ben-Gurion, the old man, was an ancient 60 years old when the state was founded. So the same people stayed in power for many years, and what did you do if you were a young man who wanted to move up? You joined the army. Well, by the 80s, Israel had a flourishing private sector, flourishing academia. There were lots of ways to express ambition. Fewer people were taking a military career. And in the meantime, the religious community started creating institutions, pre-army academies, to fortify the faith of young men before they went to the army, encourage them to become officers. And a growing percentage of the officer was coming from institutions, particularly in settlements, linked to the religious right. And as time went on, the army increasingly found itself with a problem that it was unsure whether in certain circumstances these soldiers and officers would follow the instructions of their officers or of their politicized rabbis. That is to say, the fraying of the Alta Lena example was taking place. So, in a sense, as a result of the unintended consequences of failing to make a decision in 67, we have been moving from institution to revolution, from state to movement. The state is fraying. I raise these issues not to condemn, heaven forfend, but because I believe that, first of all, it is the responsibility of the researcher and of journalism to bring the facts to public attention so that a reasoned and serious debate can take place about them. If there's anything I brought in my backpack from my American experience at the age of 21 when I went to Israel, it was that faith, as once expressed by American Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis, that sunlight is the best disinfectant, that the way for a democracy to function is for things to be in public. I believe that countries are best known by their contradictions, and the question is, which way are you going to take that contradiction? Will we allow the process of unraveling to continue, or will we establish the Second Israeli Republic, a better and more successful democracy? In order to do that, I will very briefly state, I can respond more to this during the question period, but I want to sum up what the three conditions, or the most basic three conditions I see for doing that. The first is that it is necessary to separate state and synagogue for the good of both. I stress for the good of both. I say this as a religious Jew. Judaism is not made healthier or more attractive to the public by being imposed. It will flourish when it flourishes freely of state interference. And on the other hand, the state should not be in the business of pressing people into particular religious molds. This is a divorce made in heaven. The second thing is that we need to find a better balance between the rights of the minority and majority. I believe in a Jewish state, a state with a Jewish majority, a state in which the language that we argue about the holidays, whose meanings we disagree about, that the language and the holidays are Jewish, that it's reasonable for the state to have a prize for Hebrew literature, that it's reasonable to see the state as the floor place where Jewish culture flourishes and all the arguments about what Jewish culture means flourish, but we need to find a better balance with the rights of the minority in doing so. And thirdly, most essential, and essential to achieve either of those other ends, we need to pull back, to cease ruling the West Bank, to end the settlement enterprise. The usual way that you hear the idea of giving up territory discussed in a Jewish context is that Israel would be sacrificing territory for the sake of peace. Now, I think that peace is, in fact, a sacred end and is very important. If I didn't think so beforehand, having two kids wearing green would certainly make me think so now. But I did think so beforehand. I also think that our connection to that land is clear. However, I want to reverse the paradigm. For the sake of Israel's survival as a state and a democracy, we need not to control the West Bank. The only safe way not to control the West Bank is through peace. So peace, in this sense, is a means to the end of establishing a better and more successful Israeli democracy. What is the place of the diaspora in this? I think that it's time that diaspora Jews and Israeli Jews accept that since the post-World War II period, there has been a drastic change in the Jewish condition. We are not living the Jewish reality of my grandparents. The vast majority of Jews today live in one of two conditions, either in Western countries where they enjoy freedom and equality unprecedented in Jewish history, not even unprecedented, unlike, not of the same kind as any previous situation, or they live in the sovereign state of Israel, a powerful and successful Jewish state. We need to base the relationship between the diaspora and Israel on that and not on a obsolete image of Israel as a shtetl surrounded by Islamic Cossacks. Yes, we have enemies, but when my grandparents were in the shtetl, they did not have the IDF. Our situation is different, drastically different. So my model would say the following. What Israel gives to diaspora Jews, what in fact is being discussed in the question of the gap year in the neighboring hall, what Israel gives to diaspora Jews is the amazing experience of being in a place where Jews are a majority and the culture is a Jewish culture, where you don't have to look over your shoulder when you celebrate a Jewish holiday or explain it to your non-Jewish coworkers, because that's normalcy. And if there's assimilation, it's the assimilation of a renowned Arab novelist, renowned for his Hebrew novels. Assimilation is into Jewish culture. What the diaspora offers Israel is a reminder of what it's like to be a minority, and the immediate instinctive understanding of the minority that the minority deserves equal rights. What it is like to be a stranger in Egypt and in France and in Germany and in the Lower East Side, and that the minority understands that the principle of equality is basic. So the ideal role of the diaspora in that sense is to support democracy within Israel and support the diplomatic efforts necessary to strengthen that democracy. There are tremendous problems in achieving peace, in achieving a better democracy. I do not in the least minimize any of them, but I think in order to get where we need to go, we also need to be able to recognize the goal. Thank you very much.
Okay, we have about 15 minutes for questions. If people have a question, please line up at the microphone, and let's keep it to questions.
I just want to add a sentence to what Elliot just said as the former journalism prof. A question is a short sentence seeking information. Okay, a question is a short sentence seeking information. I know that this is a wonderful, diverse community and that you have many opportunities to debate Middle East politics, but out of fairness to the rest of the audience, if you come up to ask a question, please ask a question rather than making a speech. Thank you. I guess I've because of technical issues, Elliot would like you, if you're asking questions, to come up to the microphone. Come up to the microphone.
I'm going to phrase this as a question. You may, but in the interest of disinfecting with rays of sunlight, as Mr. Justice Brandeis admonished us to do, aren't there other legal opinions contrary to Mehran's opinion? And don't you think it would be fair, in fairness to this audience, that it would be appropriate to tell them about Julia Stone's opinion, Eugene Rostow's opinions, the many opinions on the other side of that issue?
Look, as I said to you, I discuss the full range of these opinions in writing. This is a lesson in itself. What I can tell you is that the difference between Stone, by the way, Rostow as Undersecretary of State in the American administration fully supported the line of the U.S. administration at that time that settlements were a violation of the Geneva Convention. He only offered the opposing opinion many, many years later. However,
when he was an independent academic at Yale Law School.
Okay. The difference between the opinions stating that settlement is legal and Mehran's opinion and the huge majority of opinions in the area on this subject is the difference between what happens if you ask your accountant if such and such is a legitimate deduction, and he says openly, because you haven't made the decision yet, which it is, and he says, no, that's not a legitimate tax deduction. And when you go to your accountant after taking it as a deduction and say, look, I've made this a deduction, I've got a certain problem that the tax people are asking me questions about it, can you come up with an argument for why it's a legitimate deduction. In law, accounting, and other fields, there's a difference between a priori and ex post facto opinions. The simple reading of the Geneva Convention, of the Rome Statute, of the International Criminal Court, of the opinion of the International Court of Justice, including the Western representatives on that court, is that the purpose of the Geneva Convention is to protect the population living under a military occupation, which is the condition in the West Bank today as defined by the Israeli government, that who has sovereignty there is not material to the rights granted to the population, because the convention is a convention for the protection of the rights of civilians, not for the protection of the rights of other nations, and that one of those rights is that the occupying power is not allowed to take steps to change the demography within that territory. I'm not going to go into a long debate about this. The material is there. If you look at the footnotes in my book, you will find the key articles on it, including the articles that you have cited. I think the evidence is clear, but I've done my best to present all materials on this issue.
With the exception of this issue of the West Bank, which I have to admit I really don't understand, I don't know, maybe this reply was explaining how giving up the West Bank would help democracy in Israel. I don't know. I didn't understand that issue. But with the exception of that idea, you present a very beautiful vision. And I'm just wondering, are there others? Is there a party? Is there a group who share that vision and who perhaps promote it? And are there activities, stuff like that? Because I must admit, I don't really see this out there. But.
Okay. The positions that I'm presenting are what I would call mainstream left-to-center positions within the Israeli political spectrum. The Israeli political debate is far less constricted than the North American debate. This is an irony that every Israeli feels when coming here. The position, for instance, of the Kadima Party, which is a breakaway from Likud, a center party in Israeli politics, is that Israel needs to give up the West Bank for the sake of maintaining a Jewish and democratic state. Polls show that over 50% of the Israeli public supports the separation of synagogue and state. The reason that that's remained a polling issue rather than a voting issue is because the issue of the territory so totally dominates Israeli elections that the whole list of other subjects, education, economics, and so forth, has been pushed to the side in a form of political triage until we can solve the most difficult issue. During the social protests this summer, a protest movement, which may have been paralleled in some place like Greece or Spain, but certainly nowhere in North America, at the biggest single protest held this summer against the government's economic policy, 7% of the Israeli population marched on a single evening. If I'm not mistaken, that would be equivalent to something like 2 million Canadians marching in cities across the country on one night against the government's policy. It was a huge and continues to be a tidal wave of protest on economic policy. But what was most striking to me in the context of what we're talking about today is that speakers at those protests said, we're asking for free education from the end of maternity leave for every Israeli, religious and secular, Jewish and Arab. We're asking for health care for every Israeli, religious and secular, Jewish and Arab. In other words, what was developing out of those protests, a mass movement unprecedented in a Western country, was a sense of a shared civic identity between Jewish Arab citizens of the state. If you read the newspaper in Hebrew, if you participate in Israeli political discussion, the idea that Israel needs to leave the West Bank, or that settlement is harming the state of Israel, or that the entanglement of religion and state is harming both, or that a different balance is needed between the rights of the minority and the rights of the majority, that is not a universal position, but it is a position of a large portion of the Israeli public, and elections swing back and forth between that camp and the opposing camp. There's dozens, if not more, flourishing civil society organizations in the state of Israel working for various ways of disentangling the state and religion, working for human rights in the territories. And so I always feel a little bit like I've landed on Mars. When I'm in the North American context and the ideas that I'm presenting are treated as something coming out of nowhere, because what I'm presenting to you is a major piece of the Israeli political spectrum.
Not many people talk about the influence of the difficulty that young kids have
in maintaining the military presence in the territories. It seems to be doing something to a whole generation of Israeli youth. Would you comment on that, please?
The philosophical question that's being raised here is I think double. One is, what is simply duty in the territories? What does that mean to people? That's a difficult question to answer because that depends on a lot where the young people themselves are coming from and what they see as the place of the future of the territories in Israeli life. And there's a second question which has to do with putting the decisions of the state, of the elected government, over your own personal preferences. there's clearly people who feel that it's very difficult serving in the territories. The best testimony to that has been gathered by the organization Breaking the Silence, which brings testimony of Israeli soldiers about service in the territories. The organization was founded a number of years ago by two young Orthodox men after the service in the territories. My own experience has been talking to the children, my own children and the children of friends, that very often the experience of serving in the territories and particularly within Palestinian towns such as Hebron is a shock to young people and leaves them with a lot of questions afterwards. And my own children have experienced that in various ways, and because of the sensitivities of the positions that they feel, I can't really... I really can't describe that any further because my kids can't tell me what they do. It's a wonderful thing for a young person. The Army gives you orders not to talk about what you do every day to your parents. It's like... it's a real problem. On the other hand, I think that it's critical that we maintain the principle that the military, in both directions, that the military is controlled by the decisions of the elected government. And therefore, the most important role in debating this issue, the critical role in debating this issue, is by those of us who are civilians. My kids come home and tell me things, and they're upset about things. And following the rules, they don't go to political demonstrations. It's the responsibility of those of us who are older. In fact, those of us who have lived, you know, we had a book for my kids when they were 3 and 4 years old, and the key line in it was, "You made the mess, you clean up the mess." It was about bedrooms, but I think the same thing is true about politics. My generation has made the mess, and I don't want to just say, "Hi, kids, have the mess. Clean it up yourselves." We still have a mess to clean up.
Under what circumstances can you reasonably state that would allow a majority in Israel to actually set up, what are the conditions necessary for Israel to actually withdraw from the West Bank, occupied territories, Judea and Samaria, whatever you want. Not what you wish for, but what you could actually achieve that would allow that to happen.
Well, I think if you look at the best reported account of what happened in the Abbas-Olmert talks in 2008, which broke off when Olmert was indicted for everything under the sun and then had to resign and became a lame duck. But what happened up to that point in the negotiations, you see the outline of a plan which I think could be accepted by the majority of the Israelis. That plan included a demilitarized Palestinian state, the exchange of a small amount of territory which would allow the Jewish neighborhoods in East Jerusalem and the settlements that are largest and closest to the Green Line to remain in place. It called for an internationalization of the holy places in Jerusalem under a plan that's more complex than I want to go into here. It called for a symbolic return of a small number of refugees to the state of Israel in order to recognize the reality of the refugee problem without changing Israel's Jewish majority. Olmert and Abbas were down to dickering about the numbers and the exact lines. The shape of the agreement was there. Those negotiations have not continued under the current government for all sorts of reasons. And as I said, the by Olmert's own testimony, by Condoleezza Rice's testimony, by former American Ambassador Martin Indyk's testimony, the negotiations did not break off because of a substantial problem in the negotiations, but because Olmert's clock ran out early because he was indicted for doing many, many things that the law does not allow. I would add a note here. If you said to somebody on the street, would you accept this today as a theoretical thing, I don't know how the polling would come out, but my experience has been in Israel repeatedly that the reaction of the public to a solid offered peace deal and to a theoretical peace deal is entirely different. I made Aliyah in September of 1977. In September of 1977, polls would and did show that the majority of Israelis were opposed to giving up the Sinai to peace with Egypt because the Sinai was real and concrete and tangible, and peace with Egypt was an abstraction. After Sadat's visit, in which the leader of the neighboring state was offering a peace deal based on giving up the Sinai, the pendulum of politics swung to a completely different spot, because now what you were talking about is a real peace deal with real parameters that would make a real difference in the future of the state of Israel. And just to note what the parameters did, we in fact gave up the Sinai. There's been an international force in the Sinai separating Israeli and Egyptian forces since then. The portion of the Israeli GDP devoted to defense dropped from 1/3 to 5 or 6%, thereby allowing the stunning growth of the Israeli economy since then. And the single largest strategic threat to Israel was removed. So the reaction of the public to the offer of an actual offer of peace was a rational and sensible one. When you discuss a peace agreement under current circumstances, people are talking about real territory versus a theoretical agreement. At the point when leaders are able to put the actual agreement on the table before their publics, the political situation, I would suspect, would change in the same way that it has changed under those circumstances in the past. But even today, I think that that's an agreement that you could find majority support for inside the state of Israel. Elliot, or am I taking? Okay. So thank you very much.
Thank you.